Hello, and welcome to Profiles, a program where we get to meet the people who make a difference in our communities and in our lives. I'm your host, Bob Willard, and today our guest is Dr. James Mumford, director of the African American Choral Ensemble. For the next hour or so, we will ask James a few questions, play some music, and meet the person behind the persona. James, welcome to Profiles.
Morning.
Okay. James, let me introduce you to our listeners by mentioning some of your accomplishments. A successful performer, composer, educator, and musical and vocal director, James has been with the African American Arts Institute since 1976 and director of the Choral Ensemble since 1983. The ensemble has premiered several of his original compositions with many others, but ones that James has written are Black Nativity, Ebon One, and now Sojourner, which is going to be done in Kokomo in a month or two, as you mentioned.
Right, the 23rd.
And the group has gained recognition through television presentations. In 1993, Mumford was inducted into the Faculty Colloquium on Excellence in Teaching program, a prestigious honor in Indiana University in recognition of outstanding teaching. In January, on the 18th of the year 2002, in the issue of the Bloomington Herald Times, Peter Jacoby wrote, "James Mumford is a believer in the union of music and ministry. He amply proved once again that he can take a large group of young voices, many if not most of them untrained, and build a choir capable of delivering a message to anyone but a stone. Each Mumford performance becomes something of a musical sermon on the mount." James, let's get right to it. What do you transmit to those singers that so inspires them and the audience?
Really, I kind of believe that every human being has all the great possibilities lying within them, and that teachers, leaders have only to tap into that and to give these young people a sense of who they are so they can release their talents. I mean, for me, it seems rather simple. I just sort of see the beauty and the abilities in each one of them long before they see it and recognize it. And most often I find that circumstances or situation has made each of them feel somewhat less capable than they really are. And I take it as my job and my calling to help unleash that and to free them. Then everything else comes quickly and easily and miraculously.
Sounds like you give them the opportunity to take a risk.
Well, that's very important. I mean, they learn in the very beginning that risk-taking, I mean, to live life without taking risks is sort of just a static way of living. And so I explain to them that not only in music, but the same kind of willingness to step outside themselves and to try to do that which is different, to try to reach inside themselves to do what it is they think they're possible of doing, requires great bravery, because most of us are stifled by fear. And if you can help remove fear, I mean, even in our daily lives, it's the fear of things that sort of seem to stifle us. And so I try to, first of all, create an atmosphere in my classroom where students feel supported. I make it clear that there is not a hierarchy of abilities and talents, that everyone has something to give. And so there's no such thing as you often hear students like, "I can't sing after this person just sung. My God, Dr. Mumford, God, did you hear her?" And I said, "Yes, that was her. But your performance is yours." And so my students understand that I would not accept, if they want to see this teacher get really crazy, is for someone to laugh at another student or to make a snide remark. I won't tolerate it at all. And so what happens in those first few days, I think, is most of my students feel safe. And that's all it takes to learn anything, is to feel safe. A kid walks when he feels safe. He talks when he feels safe. It's mother tongue. It's natural existence. And so I try to create an atmosphere where my students have a sense of safety, but also a sense of individuality.
Jester Harrison, the great conductor and arranger, said that white people can't clap on the offbeat. Now, that's something that I took as a philosophy because I heard it from him. And yet your chorus has a very mixed membership. How does that work?
I think when Jester made that statement, it was old school world, before the pervasive influence of African-American musics. And people reflect whatever the aesthetic of their culture prescribes. They find beauty in various things. We've always, black people have always found beauty in rhythm. Drums were our life's blood. Drums were the speakers of the heart. And so rhythm is high on our scale of what is beautiful. So it's very obvious that in our culture, it's not that black people have good rhythm. It's just that we value good rhythm, and it is a part of our aesthetic process. And so that when a little kid claps, when one of our children claps and is clapping and dancing, everybody in the family is going like, oh, look at that, yay, oh, that's great, that's great. He's already being reinforced that that rhythm and that movement is something to be loved and to be responsible for. Whereas I think maybe in another culture, the same little kid may be dancing around and clapping, and they say, okay, sit down, sweetie. You're making too much noise. Or nobody really pays that much attention to it, but they may pay more attention to his spoken word or if he reads something early. I mean, it's different hierarchies of what is important. It doesn't mean that in any culture there aren't really the similar kinds of things, but it's just where they stack up. And I think rhythm stacks up very high. So at the time Jester made that comment, I think most white people tended to clap on the downbeat. There was a sense of order. One, two, three, four, and one, two. And we Africans have always found order in disorder. And so that moving that from the expected to one, two, three, just came very, very naturally. And so really it was very difficult often for people who had not been exposed to it. But the young people today, good Lord, they listen to the influence of black music in everything they hear on the radio and on TV. Almost everybody you see, though they may not acknowledge it, have as the precursor of what they're doing, and their influence comes out of the African-American tradition. So that now it's really no problem. I mean, young white kids grow up. I mean, I was driving like in Linton, and I'm passing a farm. There's a little white boy standing out in his pasture doing the backward slide, Michael Jackson's backward slide. I mean, in perfect rhythm. And it just struck me as so funny. I almost wanted to pull over and just watch that, because he had the absolute rhythms of, and that would not have happened 25 years ago. I mean, he just would not have had that kind of coordination. He would not have had that kind of body coordination to do a moonwalk. And there was this little kid out in Linton doing the moonwalk. So it was, to me, that was an example of what the influence has been, how it has shaped culture, how it has integrated into other cultures. And so that now white people have rhythm. They've always had rhythm. They just didn't value it in the same way that we value it. I don't think they have never been without rhythm. It's just that they're beginning to add some value to it. And this, it's as simple as that. At least I think so.
Well, this seems to have evolved. Well, those of us that were brought up in the Bing Crosby, Eddie Fisher era didn't have that. But those that came with Janis Joplin and on beyond seemed to have more of that rhythm built into the music that they listened to.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the majority of, for instance, rap, which so many people don't like, but which is highly rhythmical and highly danceable, rap is bought by whites about 2-1 over blacks. Even though it's considered a black form, the great buyers of rap music, according to recording industry, are white buyers. So the young white kids are not only listening to it, they're dressing like them. The language has changed. I'm sure it makes a lot of their parents very unhappy because it's so foreign to them. But zoot suits and poodle skirts and every era has this group of rebellious teens. I mean, that's where it happens.
How does that integration work in the choir? Is there any sort of separation, or does everybody integrate?
For the most part, I think our students really see each other. I think it's kind of natural to seek out what looks most like you. And it takes a little while before students can understand that your spirits look more like than your outer appearance does not look alike. And it takes a moment for them to understand that, to get to the point where they can feel that a spirit and what who you are and what you are is more important than what you look like. In the beginning, I see it each year, but I see it also fade away usually by the end of the year. In the beginning of the year, when we go on bus trips, most white students sit with white students. Most black students will sit with black students. And it's not a negative because they really treat each other very well in the classroom, at least from my observation, because I won't accept anything other than that. But they treat each other very well, and I see they talk with each other. They do things together. But in the beginning, they tend to, when we're on the bus, they tend to sit together. When we get to where we're going and we're having dinner, for the most part, the white kids will sort of sit at the same table. And sometimes I have to suggest, let's get together a little bit better, more than this. And I'll suggest to black students, don't, in case the white students don't feel, they feel somehow alienated, reach out. Because you know how that feels. And I write poetry, and one of my, I have some things called miniatures that's sort of like one-liners. And one of them says, one who has known thirst should not hesitate to give you a drink. And I explain that to my students, that you know what it feels to be isolated. You know what it feels like to be in a group and be one of a few of your kind in that group. So since you know that, you are the more knowledgeable one. You should move forward and say, hello, hi, may I join you? Or come join us. I said, because you know what it feels like. And they agree, and most of them will do that. And when it happens, I can see on the faces of the students, even though there's no hostility, I'm telling you, there really isn't any hostility, but I can still see on the faces of my white students a great relief that somebody said, I see you, come be with me, or can I join you? And so usually by the middle of the section of the year, it's beginning to move away. And then the selection becomes not forced because they're white. If they're white students who sit together, it's because they really want to sit together. It's not because they sat together as a way of having some strength in this uncomfortable situation. If black students sit together, it's not because they don't want to sit with white students. They're sitting together because they want to sit, and I think that's natural. And that's what I try to move to, so to make it as natural as possible.
So music helps become a melting pot.
Oh, absolutely. It has to be a sharing. There have been times when my choir, I've gone through a whole synthesis, whole thing of this whole business of racial mixture. When the first few white students came to choral ensemble years ago in the early 80s, it rather angered some of the black students who had attitudes that they thought, we don't have very much on this campus, and this is one of our groups. This is ours. Now here you come, you want this. I mean, you have in the School of Music, you have singing Hoosiers, you got all other kind of groups you can go to. Why are you coming here? And it was really a kind of hostility going on. I mean, it really was a strong hostility, and I really didn't like that. And I explained to the black students that you cannot do that. Music does not, I mean, sure, this is your music, but this music belongs to everybody. And if you think your music is as great as I have told you and I've helped you to discover that it is, why wouldn't people want to share it? Why wouldn't people want it? I mean, if it's good, that's why people go to McDonald's. I mean, maybe it's not good, but people go to McDonald's because they know about it and they like it. So you can't say, I only want certain people to come to buy my hamburger. No, if it's a good hamburger, people will want to eat it. And I said, what we do and what you do, it's excellent. And other people of other cultures and other groups are going to see you. They're going to hear you. Why wouldn't they want it? I would certainly want it. If I heard something that moved me as much as you move me, I'd want to be a part of that. They bought it a little bit. I mean, they still didn't feel comfortable about it. But I said, you know, you're going to respect them. And you're not going to make them feel alienated in this room. I will not tolerate it. It won't happen. I'm telling you now, if you don't like it, you leave, because I'm not going to have that. I mean, I abhor when you go into situations and no professor stands up to protect your interests. And how can I possibly not do that when the opposite occurs? when a white student comes to my room, if I really and truly in my heart want other professors to open themselves to you and to smooth the path for you in their classrooms and in their activities, how can I not do the same? I mean, I won't have that. I just can't be that. I can't flip-flop like that. And they understood that. Finally, there was a white girl who had joined, and she was a hard worker and a lover of the music. Someone nominated her for president of the African-American Choral Ensemble. And the one girl who had been the one most adamant that she just couldn't stand this white girl. She just, why don't she get out? I don't know what she's in here for. Why is she in here? This is about 5 months after we've been having these sessions. So the white girl is nominated for the president of the African-American Choral Ensemble. So she stood and said, well, thank you very much for nominating me, but I really don't think a white person should be president of a predominantly black organization, and I appreciate your nominating me, but I don't think I should be. The black girl who had been the one most adamant and the most hateful throughout the whole year stood and said, listen, honey, ain't nobody nominate you because you're white. We nominate you because you're good. Sit down. And when she said that, I mean, I knew then that all my efforts had worked because, I mean, she just said, you know, I mean, for her to say that, because I expected her to say, well, you did what was right. But she stood and she said, look, honey, nobody nominated you because you're white. We nominate you because you're good. So sit down and remain on the list. And it went on to be a wonderful, this young lady went on to be one of the finest presidents that we have had. And it was, to me, a victory. It was a victory, a signal of victory, when that the person who was the most adamant and who led much of the angst within the group made that statement, then it all just, we never had any real serious problems from that day forward. So it can happen, but somebody has to take leadership to make it happen. You can't pretend you don't see it. You can't act like it's so difficult and so, I don't want to get into the race discussion. You just can't do it. You have to stand and speak for truth. You have to stand and speak for what is right. And even though I stood the chance of some of my black students maybe calling me an Uncle Tom, I knew I was not an Uncle Tom. So I didn't care about that. My feeling was that it was right. It had nothing to do with me trying to give preference to white students. It's just that it was not right, and it's not what I would have happen to any one of them. And if I would do something to another student that I would abhor some other teacher doing to them, that's so contradictory. It's stupid. I mean, it's just silly. And so they understood that, and from that they understood that I was not being preferential toward other students who are from other cultures. It's just that I really meant that. And they said, God, he means that. And then they began to adopt that kind of stance, even in the face of thinking maybe it might not be the wisest decision sometimes. They still adopt it. I think most of them have adopted that. And I haven't tried to make them adopt anything. I just stand for what I stand. And I want them to know why I take the stand. I want them to know why I think like I think, why I do what I do. And then it's their choice they have the choice of following it or rejecting it. But now in my presence, there are things I will not tolerate.
Why don't we hear the group? Let's hear the spirit of this organization. Do you have a piece that we can listen to with this vocal ensemble?
As you know, we do actually three different genres or three different types of music, which requires three different styles of vocal technique and approach to singing. The formally composed is pretty much what any classical music would sound like, and they need to have a good classical vocal technique. The spirituals are a much darker sound, so they have to learn how to manipulate their voice to get that darker sound. And then the gospel, which they love a lot, is a much more popular sound, a belting kind of a voice from the students, and it's sort of an open, really free and open sound. And so maybe we might like to hear that one, because that expresses more strongly, I mean, all of them express strongly the African-American tradition, but the gospel is an example of one. It's called Anthem of Praise.
Let's hear it.
Praise Him with the sound of the trumpet. Praise Him with the song of your heart. Let everything that has breath praise.
We have just heard the Indiana University Afro-American Choral Ensemble conducted by our guest, Dr. James Mumford. Now, James, can you tell us a little bit about the history of that piece, the name of it again, and if, you know, who the people are that made it work?
It's Anthem of Praise, and we try to, in the choir, we try to sample the various styles and what's happening in contemporary gospel. This song that you just heard, Anthem of Praise, is an example of the work of one of the great leaders in gospel music at this time, Richard Smallwood. And Richard is known primarily for bringing in classical and Western influences into gospel. So he often, very often, he melds maybe like a Bach piece or a Bach song with a gospel. Jesus, Joy of Man's Desiring is one of his. And underneath the flow of Jesus, Joy of My Desiring, is he has this gospel thing on top of it that's absolutely beautiful. And the Hymn of Praise is another example, kind of, because he uses a kind of formalized structure. It uses a kind of an approach to singing as one might find in an anthem, a regular church anthem, a regular choir anthem, a hymn. And he brings into that the influence of gospels with the repetitions, the improvisations over top of the chorus, the building up of the harmony by having one harmony note, the tonic, at least the first note of the chord, then the third coming in with the next voice, or the fifth coming in with the next voice, and they layered. That's a very popular and a very important part of gospel, is layering, and it also, not only does it layer the sound, but it creates a kind of tension between sections. So you say, come on, sopranos, show them. And sopranos will sing their part. Altos, you're going to let them show you off. Then the altos come in. Then come on, tenors, really put it together. And it sort of keeps a kind of energetic electricity going on, no matter how many times you sing the song, because there's this little sort of friendly competition going on. And so we hear that in this song as well, as he builds up. Each time, in each verse, in each chorus, he'll build up the harmony by starting with the men, adding the alto, then adding the soprano. Then you hear all three of them. Then they do all kinds of things with it. Then they go to the next section. It may start with the sopranos, then the altos, and then the basses. So we added that because we wanted a piece that showed some of that kind of influences on gospel.
And it has the freedom of gospel.
Yes, it has the freedom of gospel.
You've had several occasions in your life when there has been an epiphany or a turnaround in your thinking. Can you share some of those with us?
I've had what I really think is an interesting life myself, maybe not to anybody else, but it's really interesting to me because I continue to have these epiphanies, and it sort of lends itself to my philosophy that to be in a state of change is good, and I'm forever learning and open to learning and wide open to whole new thoughts and never say never about anything. A person can change, and you can really change dramatically, not just small change. It can be very dramatic changes. And I have certain periods in my life. I was a precocious kid, and I started reading very early. I had an aunt who taught country school who babysat for my mother by taking me to the school at 3. And that's how my mother went back to work, and my cousin, I went with her to a country day school, and she taught first, second, third, fourth, fifth grade, all in a one-room school with the cold heater and the whole bit. And so I just sort of, she stuck me in the back of the room and gave me some pencils and paper and thought for me to scribble scrabble. But I paid very close attention, even at 3, to everything that was going on. So I learned my letters. I learned the alphabet. I learned when the first grade was doing their work, I was just very attentive. Got it. So I started to read very, very early. So by 4 or 5, I was reading newspapers, books, lots and lots of books. And I don't know whether that's where I got this precocious attitude about, but I also began to have this very strong sense of how bad racism was early. And it drove my mother almost mad. I mean, and it caused for contention throughout our lives, is that she just thought that I was crazy, really, I guess, because I would always question why and always fight very early. I remember passing the Paramount Theater, and it was the White Theater with a beautiful black exterior made of celluloid, and the doors were silver, and the glass doors were clean and very beautiful. You could look inside and see a sparkling, clean counter with candy and popcorn and velvet on the walls. I mean, God, it's where I wanted to be. And I wanted to go into this movie house, and my mother said, no, we can't go in there. And I said, why? And she said, because we're black. And infuriated me. And I was only about, I remember the first time that happened, I was about four. And I snatched away from my mother's hands and ran over to the theater and just spat on it. It angered me. So I hated it, and I spat on it. And she was very angry with me. I couldn't understand why she didn't spit on it, too. And I told her so. And I didn't understand, why are you yelling at me? For they won't let us go in there. Why aren't you spitting on it, too? It was much later that I learned that she was trying to protect me because I could have been harmed very bad for doing something like that in North Carolina in 1940-something. Yeah, 1940. I could have been hurt for doing that. But I did not know that. That was a childhood epiphany that it was. At four, I knew that that was wrong. I had a sense that I didn't belong there. I shouldn't be there. I didn't want to be there. And so I rather hated it. I hated it wherever I saw it. I not only hated it, I physically did things. I took action. And that kind of thing went on. And it sort of colored a lot of how my first reactions when I went to college and all. And during the 60s, I was a very active activist. I was very much so an activist. I let that go when I found that some of the people who were in the movement with me were not sincere. I was kind of not a Martin Luther King type person. I was more a Malcolm. My anger would not allow me to be nonviolent or to think of love as an answer to this feeling that I had. I really did not have that. But I think Martin is the person who shaped my thinking, and when I began also to read more about Gandhi and began to read more about Jesus and began to read more about people who began to use love and nonviolence as a way of dealing with people, that it kind of softened my hatred, made me do an introspective thing and realize that all this energy that I was using to feed anger had very little effect on the people that I was angry at. But the anger had a lot of effect on me because I was always in a state of just anger. And so I think I let go. That was very, very big. I mean, I can't, the champion that I am for rights for all people now is in direct opposition to the first half of my life because I was very, very bitter about the racial situation in this country. And I knew it was not right. I did not have the ideas of love to supplant that. I just knew it was not right, and I wanted it right. And I wanted to do what I could to wrong it. If it meant war, it meant war. But the epiphany came, I think, through Martin, through my religious conversion, because I was not a very religious child. My family was not very, very religious. But when I became very religious, all of this turned around and I began to see that that was not the way that I wanted to live my life, and that if I lived my life with love, that not only would my enemy benefit, but most of all, I benefited because I was at peace. I was not in a state of flux. And so that wasn't a great epiphany for me.
And then you almost drowned.
Yes. That happened the year I came to Bloomington. I came to Bloomington in 76, and I had been playing tennis all morning with some friends and another brother we were in graduate school in the music school together. And I had just taken some summer courses work, not like officially entered my program until September, but I came for my second master's and my doctorate. And I went swimming at Lake Monroe after a whole morning and the day before playing tennis. And I things seem quite all right to me, and it's a long story, so there's no way we could talk about all that today. I'll cut it short by simply saying that a gentleman who I spoke came in the water and was sort of refereeing a game that we had made up. And I asked him, excuse me, sir, are you busy? Could you referee this game? He said, sure, of course I will. And he went on to referee the game, and the people I was with had been arguing that I was cheating and that I didn't win. He refereed the game. I won. Ha, ha, ha. So, I mean, I achieved my goal that somebody outside of the group agreed. And so then we sort of split and stopped. Everybody just stopped playing the game. We were tired of it. He started talking to me. He started telling me a lot about myself that was really strange to me. He kept saying, you just came to Bloomington, didn't you? I said, yeah. He said, you just made a real life-changing choice in lately, haven't you? And I was going like, who is this man? I'm going like, yes, because I had just gotten divorced. I had just left a very successful position and job, dropped everything to come back to school. And it was they were major decisions. So he said, well, I think you made the right decision, sir. And he went on, and then I sensed that he was psychic, or there was some kind of brotherly thing between us. And so he left. I insisted that he give me his address and phone number because I felt immediately brotherly toward him, and I wanted to talk to him. He said, well, that won't be necessary. So then I thought maybe he thinks he doesn't want to give me his number because he thinks he's looking at me as a black man. He don't know whether I'll rob him. He doesn't know me. And I said, but I'd just like to have your number. I would like to give you a call because I felt we sort of connected here. He said, I'm saying that won't be necessary. Do you understand? And I thought, well, okay, that's deep for me. But I said, okay. I left him, went out to swim. I don't really know what happened. Most of the story I got from him, he was on his way out. His wife and kid were waiting for, his kid was in the water with us, and they went up to change clothes to leave. And just as they were about to get in the car, someone said, someone is drowning. He came. He knew immediately, he said, that it was me. So he turned around, took his shoes off, but his clothes, he kept his clothes on because he was just ready to get out. And I was underwater for about 40, 45 minutes before he found me. He's the one who found me. They lost me for about 45 minutes. I was like hundreds of yards from where they saw me go under, and I was in about 25 feet of water. And he was from Australia and had been taught as a young man to dive for pearls without benefit of any kind of oxygen or mass. So the reality is that there is nobody else who could have found or saved me that day, really. They would have been taking so much longer for them to get the divers in and the boats in and all that kind of stuff. He just jumped in and did it. And he found me, and he brought me back to the top. They worked on me for about, I guess, half an hour there until they finally got me breathing. I got some pulse. There was no pulse when they got me out of the water. And they took me to Bloomington Hospital, and I was in convulsions for about, I guess, a half an hour. And that evening at around 11, I was clinically dead for 11 minutes. I don't know how long I was dead under the water, but we know that there was a flat EGG, EKG, the whole thing, for about 11 minutes in the hospital. And I had an out-of-body experience. We won't talk about that today, but I had a really strong out-of-body experience. At that time, I had not read anything about out-of-body experiences. That was in 1976, and I didn't know anything about that. So I don't believe that I had read, and it was some suggestions that came to me. It really happened. And it was very profound. It was very miraculous. Once they got my heart beating again, I stayed in a coma for 5 days. And at the end of 5 days, I said to the doctor, I've got to go over to the School of Music. I came out of the coma just unexpectedly. And I said, I got to go for auditions. And he said, sir, you're not going for any auditions anytime soon. Are you aware that you were underwater for 45 minutes? You were clinically dead. You've been in a coma for 5 days. We have to watch you for the next 4 or 5 days. No, I got to go audition. I raised such a ruckus that they let me out. I signed myself out that I would not hold him nor the hospital responsible. And I went in on a Saturday. I stayed in the coma Monday, Saturday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. I woke up on Friday. I signed myself out on Friday and showed up for auditions in the MAC on Saturday and sang. And it was really miraculous because all of my friends didn't even know I was out of the hospital. They had been mourning my coma and death. And then Michael Gordon, who was a dear friend of mine, was sitting in the audience. And I walked out on stage in this white suit, which was the only thing I had clean. And he just about lost it because he thought he was having a mirage. He thought he didn't know what was going on. There I was standing in this white suit. And I sang, and I got the role of Crown that year, and I used Porgy and Bess. I did the Flying Dutchman. So I was determined to do what I came here to do. That was another great epiphany, and that was my rebirth in 1976.
Well, there's a wonderful recording of you singing Ain't Got Time to Die, which seems very appropriate to hear right now. Could we play that? That seems appropriate under the circumstances.
Great.
Ain't Got Time to Die with James Mumford.
Keep so busy praising my Jesus. Keep so busy praising my Jesus. Ain't got time. 'Cause when I'm healing the sick, I'm praising my Jesus. When I'm healing the sick, Lord, I ain't got time to die. 'Cause it takes all of my time to praise my Jesus. All of my time to praise my Lord. If I don't praise him, the rock's gonna cry out, Gloria, Nana. Gloria, Nana, I ain't got time. Lord, I keep so busy working for the kingdom. I keep so busy working for the kingdom. Keep so busy working for the kingdom. Ain't got time to die. 'Cause when I'm killing the fish, I'm praising the Jesus.
We have just heard our guest James Mumford singing Ain't Got Time to Die, a recording he made as part of his doctoral recital.
Yes.
James, you stated that your grandmother passed to you the wisdom of life. What was that?
Well, my grandmother was not a formally trained and formally educated woman, but I can just remember just certain things that she has said to me early in my life that have become sort of hallmarks of how I think and what I believe. And one of them that she used to always say to me was that, baby, observation is better than education. And I was a very educated-oriented person, and I never could quite understand, what does she mean, observation? Nothing is better than education. And she said, observation is better than education. And as I have come to live and as I've integrated that into my life, that, again, is one of the hallmarks of my way of living and my way of teaching particularly, is to be very observant. And that often tells me more than I could ever get from any other source. My kids, they think that I have powers, but it's really just I have powers of observation. But like I can sense things. I can feel and sense, but it comes out of observations. I must have at least 2,000 eyebrow movements cataloged in my brain. And I have an equal number of lip movements and head positions and shoulder positions and chest positions and back positions and eye positions that I can look at the combination and just tell you what's going on just from those. They think I'm reading their minds, but I'm really reading their bodies. So a student will come in and I'll go like, what's wrong, sweetheart? And they'll go like, oh, nothing. I go, no, something's wrong. What's the matter this morning? And after about one more question, I got tears just flooding down. I mean, just, you know, the student just falling apart. Like, how did you know? How could you know? But, I mean, observation tells you these kinds of things. And I try to instill that in particularly those who want to be teachers, but even just in life, even with your family, even with your wife, your husband, your children, observation really is just a powerful tool. And most people don't bother. They just sort of blindly look ahead and go through things without. But it has been one of my greatest safeguards, and it's been one of the great things that has enabled me to do what I do and enabled me to understand. It is the key to my empathy. It's the key to my sensitivity, my observation. And so that's just one of many examples of how she, this woman who I think finished 8th grade, has just influenced my life and my way of thinking with some of the wise things that she gave to me and that she said to me.
We know of you as a choral conductor. We just heard you singing, but you had the potential for a great career in opera.
Yes.
Can you touch on that?
When I came out of school, that was why I thought I came to the planet. Even though at that time, the concept of why I came to the planet was not even in my mind. That's something that has come later. But I thought that I was meant to be. I was so certain that God had intended me to be a great opera singer. And I worked very hard at it, very hard at it. Aldrich Atkins was my voice teacher at Virginia State University in Petersburg. And he was an absolutely fantastic tenor who said to me, you know, Earl, when I see you standing on the stage of the Met, all of the pain that I have carried from not being there will be removed. And I don't know if I understood the strength of that kind of commitment to me that he made. And he said, I will do whatever is necessary to get you to do that. I was kind of stupid and rebellious because I wanted to get married. He said to me, please, whatever you do, don't get married right now. Just give me a year. Give me a year, so because we're going to need that. And I said, look, you are my voice teacher, not my father. I'm in love. I'm getting married like an idiot. And I did. And I just didn't listen. That was the first mistake. But then I ran into the racism musically. No one just believed that there was any place for a black male singer in opera. The impresarios, even though I sung with some very fine voices, and even though I sang for Laszlo Halas, I did a lot of things with Maestro Halas, they still were afraid to put me on main stage with a white soprano or a white woman playing the opposite part. They thought it just would not go. They thought it would not sell. And so time and time and time again, I just ran up against these walls. And then I began to wonder, is it that I don't have it? I mean, am I not good enough? And it was really horrible because everywhere else in my life, it seemed that I was good enough. My teachers, fellow singers, I'd go to competitions and all the other, all the struggling artists know each other because we all at the same competitions. And they would say, in the beginning, they would say, oh, God, Mumford's here today. I should have stayed home. He's here today. But when it was over, I should have stayed home because invariably, when they gave third place, second place, first place, I was never in any of the places. And it was really astonishing because I used to sit when they were named third place. I'm like, well, I know I'm not in third place. So I didn't even bother to try to get myself ready to go on stage. They say second place. I think maybe I better get to the edge of my seat so that I can make sure my jacket is straight. And then when I didn't get second, I'd just say, this is it. So I would prepare myself. I would be thinking like, okay, now shall I jump up or shall I come up easy? Shall I be very dignified in the way I rise? Shall I run to the stage? Shall I walk to the stage? How shall I do this? And then they'd call the first place and it wouldn't be me. And then I suddenly realized that not only did I not get first, I didn't get second or third. And it would be just devastating. And so that went on for years. I mean, it went on for a long, long time. It just nobody. And finally, Doris DeRay, a very fine mezzo from the Met, heard me and just fell in love with my voice and said, you are going to sing. And she began teaching me all the roles and working with all the roles. And she had an opera theater in New York called the DeRay Opera Studio Theater. And we sang across the whole country doing opera. It was on a very small scale. We made our costumes. We sort of had just peripheral kinds of sets and et cetera. And I had much success with that, but never able to move beyond the mainstream. So it was devastating to me. I mean, I almost left music totally. I wanted nothing to do with it. And I just thought, God, why did you give me this voice if you're not going to allow me to use it? And, you know, I just everything just began to crash around me. Like, why all this work? Why all this effort? And just know it was so very frustrating. And so finally, I mean, I think psychologically I tried to commit vocal suicide. I just misused my voice. And when teaching, because when I taught before, I'd be very careful not to yell, not to sing the soprano part in full voice, to protect my voice. When I was teaching the choir in high school, etc., I just began to just grate on it like a grater with my voice, because I wanted to destroy it, because I just felt like, what's the point? And I ended up doing that. I ended up with nodules and having to have them removed and being silent for almost 6 months. I couldn't speak I was not allowed to speak for about 6 months. And then all of a sudden, I began to treasure, because I kept thinking while I was silent, is my voice really gone? Oh, God, is it really gone? Did I really destroy it? Did I mess it up? And I would just sort of go in dark corners and go, to see if it was still. Then I stopped. I'm not supposed to do that. But I had to just keep testing to see if it was there. Finally, it did come back, and it was fine. My voice is fine. But by this time, I decided I couldn't do that anymore. And finally, God knocked me in the head to say, you're a teacher, boy. You came to the planet to teach, not to sing. And that was a great epiphany for me. I no longer had any hatred about the fact that I didn't have the career, which was my whole life was aimed at having that career. It just came as clear to me as a bell that I sent you to the planet to teach. I didn't send you there to sing. And so that's what you are. And once I accepted that, everything in my life fell into place. Just so I've been just the happiest man since then, because I know why I'm here. I mean, I fully know why I was sent to the planet. And so that it's erased all the horrible feelings I had about it. I still kind of think that there's nobody who could do my version of Otello the way I can do it. I kept thinking that, God, I make a bargain with you. I'll do what I'm doing if you let me do one great Otello someplace. So it's not over yet. I'm still living, so I may one day do I did it once with the Harlem Opera Company, and I think it was fantastic, because I think I brought to Otello what the sensibilities of a black man who really could sing it, but who also really understood the character a whole lot. And I just thought that none of the guys I saw, even the greatest singers in the world, they didn't really have the understanding of what was feeding Otello. And so that I had made that bargain. So I haven't given up that bargain with God, but I kind of said to him, I will teach gladly, but before I die, how about letting me do one Otello someplace that's big, not some little auditorium in Podunk, but let me do Otello real big. So he hasn't given me that promise yet. He hasn't given me the vision that that's going
to
happen.
Yes, but he's given you a talent to make other people sing. And
yes,
that's
he has.
What we have enjoyed. And I'd like to finish the program, if you don't mind, with your chorus, again singing, Sooner We'll Be Done. You have been listening to Profiles, where we meet the person behind the persona. Our guest today has been Dr. James Mumford, performer, composer, educator, and musical and vocal director of the choral ensembles of the African American Arts Institute. James, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Bob.
It was our pleasure. This is Bob Willard. Thank you for listening.
Sooner we'll be done with the troubles of the world, the troubles of the world, the troubles of the world. Sooner we'll be done with the troubles of the world, going home to live with God. Sooner we'll be done with the troubles of the world, the troubles of the world, the troubles of the world. Sooner we'll be done with the troubles of the world, going home to live with God.
I want to meet my mother.
I want to meet my mother.
I want
to meet my mother.
I'm going to live with God.
The program you just heard was recorded in the studios of WFIU in January of 2002, Christina Kuzmich, producer. The recording engineer and editor was Michael Paskash, Luann Johnson, research assistant. For WFIU, thanks for listening.